resume the summary. The meaning of Sri Aurobindo's poetry with respect to Savitri. So I outlined last time the journey based upon what Sri Aurobindo said about epic, the role of the epic in the future poetry. He spoke about using action and speech and scene, setting and circumstance and metaphor, not for the purpose of storytelling, not for the purpose of storytelling. So the new use of the epic form is for the purpose of communicating the epic movement of life and consciousness and spirit, the inner truth of things. Circumstance and speech and movement and event become expressions of soul qualities and experiences. And then we have to recognize that we're speaking here about Sri Aurobindo's poetry, and Sri Aurobindo is speaking about his poetry, and so it's the mind of Sri Aurobindo that is conveyed in his poetry. He has a message, he has a consciousness, a point of view, a kind of knowledge that he, that is inner knowledge and universal knowledge, and of inner knowledge and universal knowledge of existence. And so he makes all of existence the field of expression for his inner view of things. So it's not story anymore. Epic is used now for something else. And in Savitri, we see that it's very, very specific. He is teaching about his yoga, how this transformation comes about, how he did it, how she does it, what we do, how we are when we approach death, how we are to be, and what is necessary in order for us to be that. So the stages of the path are the journey of Savitri. It's the journey of the soul. It's the journey of consciousness. So this is Sri Aurobindo fulfilling his prophecy of what the future poetry can be. It's an epic of the spirit, which means the epic of the inner reality of existence. So everything is symbolic. Every metaphor, every image, every event is an expression of a soul state, a deep inner reality.
Does it, Does it come straight from the soul experience to the soul if it is open and waits for some of this vibration? I mean, it has the power of mantra, as you said before, right? So the knowledge which is coming together, because I'm very curious how it works for the mind and for the soul as well. So mind is very transparent and receiving the information, because there is an information for the mind, from the mind of Sri Aurobindo, but to our small minds, I don't know exactly how it works, but the impact is very strong, actually. Even if you have a small
Yeah, my personal view of that, if I understand what you're saying, is that what is being transmitted is not fundamentally information for your mind. So if your mind gathers what it calls information from this hearing, that's the part that you're playing in the process. That's your mind is capturing something and fitting it into your framework so that you can identify with it in terms of your own understanding of things. But I think that what Sri Aurobindo is really doing is something else. And so most, you know, as I've said before, you can read Savitri in as many different ways as there are people to read it. And they're all valid. But I think we also need to recognize that Sri Aurobindo has said himself that what he's trying to do is transmit from the highest levels of attainable consciousness the force of truth. It's a transformational mantra. And so at some point in our progressive development of being able to hear, because he said also a new poetry also requires a new faculty of reception, hearing. And so we have to recognize that there are limits, that we have limits, but the purpose of this poetry is to push those limits, eventually break those limits down, and ultimately to transmit directly to the soul the truth. And in order for that to happen, one has to be quite strong as well, because your aspiration has to meet his aspiration at some point on the path, and then you're in communication with consciousness, and it's not him and you and anyone else interpreting anything, it's just the powerful reality that the word brings into being. And that word is Savitri. She is the goddess of illumined and illuminating speech. And so at some point she is invoked and becomes present and fills you not only with understanding but with the force itself. And so when your cells start vibrating and the top of your head starts vibrating, and you not only see the meaning but you become identified with it, then Sri Aurobindo is doing his work. And he has said to us many times that this Well, I don't need to repeat that. So mantra is something that we will come to in the next phase of this workshop. Right now we're in the phase of meaning. We began with the phase of metrical structure and form and spirit, and now we've begun to look at meaning. So everything that I just said is about the meaning of Sri Aurobindo's poetry. But in a very general way. Now when we come to Savitri, we come to very specific aspects of the meaning of this poetry. And so, you know, I can summarize it abstractly in very simple terms. And then we can see exactly how he communicates these elements that I'm choosing to focus on, because they are major elements, and I can find dozens of examples of them throughout Savitri. So there are certain elements of the meaning that Sri Aurobindo is conveying that stand out very clearly as the meaning of Savitri. And it's not only Savitri, but you find the same thing in all of his poetry. So I'm pointing to the journey of the soul through the plains in order to become conscious of the universal principles and powers of conscious existence, and ultimately to find the soul. That's the movement. And this is the journey, and it is that pattern is repeated in every canto. Then there is the theme of sacrifice. So we read several examples of that last time. This journey is done for a purpose, and it requires the ultimate sacrifice. So not only is there the theme of sacrifice, but there is the message of the necessity of sacrifice. And so he has used the Christian mythological language to convey that idea of sacrifice. We heard it last time in several places. We'll hear some more of it tonight. It's the sacrifice of Savitri and the sacrifice of Asvapati is for the sake of the world, to change suffering into light and joy at the roots of suffering, not any longer to accept the Buddhistic idea that we can step out of suffering and find liberation, but and not also to accept the Christian ideal of sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice, because in the end the only possible salvation is also beyond this realm. This realm is characterized by suffering, so you admit that, and you don't really try to get out of it. You suffer, and that's the essential. By suffering, you experience grace and mercy and charity and love. So both of these paths are taken, in this yoga. And we will see them recurring again and again, both of these paths. So tonight I'll read one section in which they are absolutely combined. But ultimately, the purpose is something, a third thing, a third type of sacrifice, which is the Vedic sacrifice. It's the original sacrifice, and it results in the descent of the divine and the manifestation of the divine here. And it first happens here, right now, in the reading. It's possible for it to happen today. I sound like a Christian preacher now, huh? But the magical aspect of Savitri is that Sri Aurobindo has brought this energy through this mantric speech to us in a way that can be realized at any time. But it doesn't stop there. That's when it starts. And then one works with that energy for a lifetime, and it becomes the reality, because in that process consciousness is transformed. And then it's no longer a journey through the planes of universal consciousness. It is being on the planes of universal consciousness, from the soul perspective, with the spirit pouring in. So this is the goal. And Savitri is that path, and is that force, and is that goal. And all of the different movements and speeches which occur and experiences that are narrated are of that spirit, of that experience, for that purpose. This poem is a living embodiment of this path of yoga. And it's not a story at all. And it's not a teaching in the strict traditional sense. It's not a sutra that tells you all of these things which it tells you. It rather transmits the spirit of these things to you. So when your mind catches something that sounds like a moral or a principle or an instruction, it's there, it's embedded there, but the context in which it is being given to you is the movement itself. You know, so a part of you may catch the meaning of it in terms of a principle, like the principle of sacrifice. But when you read that canto and that section, you then become that sacrifice. You then feel that suffering. And a shift takes place. And then you're in a position to be a real human being, and not an artificial one. Then you're in a position to walk on the path and experience emptiness as a way of being, for the sake of the end, which is the filling up of the emptiness by a different kind of force than the mind is able to generate, or the life is able to generate, or the body is able to generate. That force can be generated, but it's a different kind of force. And unless all of these planes are empty and receptive, it doesn't get generated. So we're going to walk through that, which is the third category, that I would mention, and I would call that category the method. The method that Sri Aurobindo communicates through Savitri. The teaching itself, as far as method is associated with the idea of teaching. The how to do it. Yes.
So I was absent, of course. I know, but maybe you explained it before. What is the sense of sacrifice? If it not, of course, like Christian and. What is the meaning of sacrifice for?
I would like for you to be able to watch last week's presentation. We'll give you a CD, a DVD.
Okay.
And then you can watch it and listen to it, because that was the whole topic last week. No, I don't want to forget it, and I don't want you to forget it, because the question that you're asking is very important. And so how to find the soul, how to walk on this path of sacrifice in a way that is not the traditional way. So that is the third category of the meaning of Savitri. And that's the one we're going to explore tonight. So it begins with the yoga of Aswapati, and we heard a bit about it last night, the sacrifice of Aswapati, if you recall. Exactly the same path is followed by Savitri. So she repeats everything that he did. So we hear it again. We hear it all in the yoga of Aswapati, and then we hear it all again in the yoga of Savitri. So with Savitri's yoga, it begins with this command. And this is very close to that passage from Canto 5 of Book 1, which we read last time, which is where Sri Aurobindo expresses most explicitly his experience of yoga. So here, she is at the beginning of the path, and she's ready to give up. Her suffering is too great. She doesn't believe that humanity is worth the effort. And she hears this voice. So here again we get this dichotomy. We get the problem. The problem is stated, and then the answer is stated. The problem is the call, and then the answer is what comes down as a result of the call. This is the Vedic structure. So I'm not reading the call, I'm reading the answer. But it comes just before. So this is, if you want to make a note of this, we are in Book 7, Canto 2, and it is a 3-page dialogue. And so here Sri Aurobindo is using the form of speech. Strong speech. Savitri's speech just before this response is a truly profound call of suffering. And so the response comes, I am thy portion here, charged with thy work. As thou, myself, seated forever above, speak to my depths, O great and deathless voice, command, for I am here to do thy will. I am thy portion here, charged with thy work, as thou, myself, seated forever above, speak to my depths. O great and deathless voice, command, for I am here to do thy will. Can you imagine yourself speaking that directly to your highest being with that depth of sincerity? If you do, this is what you will hear. The voice replied, "Remember why thou camest. Find out thy soul. Recover thy hid self. In silence, seek God's meaning in thy depths. Then mortal nature change to the divine. Open God's door. Enter into his trance. Cast thought from thee, that nimble ape of light. In his tremendous hush, stilling thy brain. His vast truth wake within, and know, and see. Cast from thee sense, that veils thy spirit's sight. In the enormous emptiness of thy mind, thou shalt see the Eternal's body in the world. Know him in every voice heard by thy soul, in the world's contacts meet his single touch. All things shall fold thee into his embrace. Conquer thy heart's throbs. Let thy heart beat in God. Thy nature shall be the engine of his works. Thy voice shall house the mightiness of his word. Then shalt thou harbor my force and conquer death. What follows for the next seven cantos is Savitri's obedience to this command. And so we get to see what it's like to do that in very precise detail. So, for example, on page 522, this process of stilling the brain and entering into God's trance goes like this. At first she stepped into a night of God. The light was quenched that helps the laboring world. The power that struggles and stumbles in our life. This inefficient mind gave up its thoughts. The striving heart, its unavailing hopes. All knowledge failed. And the ideas forms, and wisdom screened in awe her lowly head, feeling a truth too great for thought or speech. Formless, ineffable, forever the same, an innocent and holy ignorance, adored like one who worships formless God, the unseen light she could not claim nor own, in a simple purity of emptiness. Her mind knelt down before the unknowable. All was abolished save her naked self, and the prostrate yearning of her surrendered heart. There was no strength in her. No pride of force. The lofty burning of desire had sunk, ashamed. A vanity of separate self. The hope of spiritual greatness fled. Salvation she asked not, nor a heavenly crown. Humility seemed now too proud a state. Herself was nothing. God alone was all. Yet God she knew not, but only knew he was. A sacred darkness brooded now within. The world was a deep darkness, great and nude. The void held more than all the teeming worlds. This blank felt more than all that time has borne. This dark knew dumbly, immensely, the unknown. But all was formless, voiceless, infinite. As might a shadow walk in a shadowy scene, a small knot passing through a mightier knot. A night of person in a bare outline, crossing a fathomless, impersonal night. Silent she moved, empty and absolute. In endless time, her soul reached a wide end. The spaceless vast became her spirit's place. I'm going to leave it there because I think it's very important for us to dwell for some time on the depth and importance and necessity of this movement. In every case, it's followed by a descent in Savitri. Wherever there is a dwelling in the emptiness, for however long or however short, it's followed by a descent and a realization. So this pattern is repeated throughout Savitri, and we will come to that, an example of that. But first, I'd like to ask the question: how is it possible to live in such a state? What would it mean to live in that state?
I think Aurobindo himself said that it was so strong that Ananda, that he was himself afraid of.
But I'm speaking about the emptiness.
Yeah, it could be the same.
Where, no, it's actually that comes afterwards in the cycle. But before that comes, just the process of annihilating the sense mind requires a lot of emptiness. That part of the journey, that part of the path is arduous. It doesn't happen like that. And when it does happen, then how does one function? So this is the topic of the next section that I'm going to read. On page 536, Sri Aurobindo has answered this question. And here is where the path of emptiness, nirvana, and the path of sacrifice and suffering and crucifixion converge. It's a very interesting amalgamation of these two movements. This is a bit further along, but it's still the same movement, because each time that there is a response, however luminous, it affirms the utility of the emptiness. This is 536. Yes, here's where we join Buddhism. This is where the path of Sri Aurobindo joins the path of the Buddha.
Nothing new.
Nothing new. Nothing new for the moment. What's perhaps new, and Sri Aurobindo has written about this in The Life Divine very beautifully, what's perhaps new is he says this is what the Buddha really meant all the time, and this is what we need to understand, that this is what he meant and it wasn't something else. It's the same movement, but it has to be followed in a certain with a certain kind of intention. There's a series of commentaries on Savitri that I recorded, which are on the website, dealing with this Buddhist yoga versus transformational yoga. Last year we did a few sessions about that, so you can read them. You can read them and listen to them both, I think, but they're transcribed on the website, Uhu website, yeah. The University of Human Unity. That's everyone here is supposed to be subscribed to the website, because there's a lot of related material available there on our courses. And some people are actually listening to these recorded sessions. Only her soul remained. Its emptied stage. Awaiting the unknown eternal will. Only her soul remained, its emptied stage, awaiting the unknown eternal will. Then, from the heights, a greater voice came down. The word that touches the heart and finds the soul. The voice of light after the voice of night. The cry of the abyss drew heaven's reply. So, if we can manage the abyss, if we can enter into it and genuinely cry from that poise of utter emptiness, there will be a reply. The call. Did I say call? If there is a call that emanates from that profound emptiness, because that emptiness needs light, that aspiration is the real one. Not the one that we think we're supposed to have.
It is up to us to put light in that emptiness.
This is the path. This is what she was instructed to do. You annihilate yourself, and then God can become present as you. And don't think that it's still going to be the same old you. If you want it to be the same old you in a new dress, then forget it. We'll see. We'll see that. At the end of this passage. The cry of the abyss drew heaven's reply. You see how you can read it so that the tonal quality is reinforcing, is harmonious, is one. This is one word. The cry of the abyss drew heaven's reply. A might of storm chased by the might of the sun. Now, if you think those terms, might of the sun, belong in a whispered hearing, then you don't get it. You don't understand that these words carry power. And it's only the mother's force, the absolute divine power, that can make you still enough to receive something. That's why she spent all of those years bringing down that force. This is a yoga of force. So something has to come to change the way we normally function. As long as all of those regular impulses are working away, Nothing is going to change, but the little human will can't stop them from working away. Something else has to come down and press them into submission. And so this is the meaning of calling the mother's force. So here's the word that sneaks in behind this call. O soul, bear not thy kingdom to the foe. Consent to hide thy royalty of bliss, lest time and fate find out its avenues and beat with thunderous knock upon thy gates. Hide whilst thou canst thy treasure of separate self behind the luminous rampart of thy depths, till of a vaster empire it grows part. But not for self alone the self is one. Content abide not with one conquered realm. Adventure all to make the whole world thine, to break into greater kingdoms, turn thy force. Fear not to be nothing, that thou mayest be all. Assent to the emptiness of the Supreme, that all in thee may reach its absolute. Accept to be small and human on the earth, interrupting thy newborn divinity, that man may find his utter self in God. If for thy own sake only thou camest, if for thy own sake only thou hast come, and an immortal spirit into the mortal's world, to found thy luminous kingdom in God's dark, in the inconscience realm, one shining star, one door in the ignorance opened upon light. Why hadst thou any need to come at all? Thou hast come down into a struggling world to aid a blind and suffering mortal race, to open to light the eyes that could not see, to bring down bliss into the heart of grief, to make thy life a bridge twixt earth and heaven. If thou wouldst save the toiling universe, the vast universal suffering feel as thine. Thou must bear the sorrow that thou claimest to heal. The daybringer must walk in darkest night. He who would save the world must share its pain. If he knows not grief, how shall he find grief's cure? If far he walks above mortality's head, how shall the mortal reach that too high path? The last part of this voice, which brings us back to the initial movement. If thou wouldst a little loosen the vast chain, draw back from the world that the idea has made. Thy mind's selection from the infinite, thy senses gloss on the infinitesimal's dance. This is draw back thy mind's selection from the infinite. Draw back from the world that the idea has made thy mind's selection from the infinite. Thy senses gloss on the infinitesimal's dance, then shalt thou know how the great bondage came. Banish all thought from thee, and be God's void. Then shalt thou uncover the unknowable, and the superconscient conscious grow on thy tops. Infinity's vision through thy gaze shall pierce. Thou shalt look into the eyes of the unknown, find the hid truth in things seen null and false. Behind things known, discover mysteries rear. Thou shalt be one with God's bare reality. And the miraculous world he has become. And the diviner miracle still to be. When nature, who is now unconscious God, translucent grows to the eternal's light, her seeing his sight, her walk his steps of power, and life is filled with a spiritual joy. and matter is the spirit's willing bride. Consent to be nothing and none. Dissolve time's work. Cast off thy mind. Step back from form and name. Annul thyself, that only God may be. Thus spoke the mighty and uplifting voice. So when we get to the mantra stage of our presentation, we'll explore that a little bit more. Because this whole passage, which is very grave and very profound, can also be given an absolutely miraculous uplift of sound.
A piece for you, a sound to the emptiness of the Supreme. I think the last line says it all.
Right. Every line says it all.
Yeah.
So the all is in fact the nothing. And this recurs again and again in Savitri. But to perceive that, to really grasp the meaning of that, requires a turn of mind and consciousness that is not easy to attain. But it can, you can catch it. Sri Aurobindo really wants us to catch it. And so he continually builds up this duality, this dichotomy of all and nothing. And there are many opportunities that occur for the glimpse of it, for the glimpse of the infinite to pierce our mortal vision. And that image is very real. That what he said to her in this line is something that can happen as a matter of course in the reading of Savitri. That gaze of the infinite can pierce the mortal vision. But your perceptive apparatus needs to be resonant with a kind of energy that enables that to happen. So this is the real work of Savitri, to enable us to raise the vibrational framework to that level of resonance that these images become experiences at the moment of hearing them, at the moment of reading them. And then it's not the mind at all that's interpreting something.
Is it the receptivity, or it has to be an active willing condition? How is it?
It's an active receptivity.
Noise of our manifested consciousness, which is veiling all the time the presence.
possible presence of the higher consciousness. It's a step towards it. That which will be is not nothingness.
Yeah, well, I disagree completely with that statement. Because what I'm suggesting is that the word nothingness and the word emptiness has a quality of fullness that is beyond conception. So there are two nothingnesses.
There is a line which says, walk nothing so to be absolute.
Vladimir, if you think about immortality, if you think about the meaning of that word, immortality, something which is infinite and eternal and luminous and unchanging, but is at the same time present in the context of matter and life and mind, then doesn't it impose upon matter, life and mind a kind of qualitative emptiness to which it adds itself? But itself cannot be all of that, because it is more than all of that. So to be all of that plus more than all of that results in a qualitative emptiness that is an affirmation of everything, holding everything in its sphere, at the same time negating everything.
Well, this is the part of the canto of negating absolute, nirvana or negating absolute. This is the part of the path which has to be realized in this particular way, and it has its value, immense value, but there is more to it. This negation of all that noise which prevents the divine to enter with its will is a part of the path. That's what Sri Aurobindo did, first step. Then it happened differently. And it's all described in Savitri. I'm not contradicting this thought. That I'm not questioning the validity of this emptiness. What I'm saying, this emptiness is the condition all to appear. If all is to appear, then the condition has to be emptiness. There actually is not emptiness. Emptiness is the device. Emptiness is the psychological method. That's why I say always that Buddhism is psychologically true, not metaphysically. So Buddhism cannot be understood metaphysically. It's absolute nonsense. But psychologically, as a treatment of consciousness, to reach to that state where all is reached is very valid. So in this case, of course, it's exactly what I want to confront your thought. Only to see these two parts, because it's very Vedic in a way. The whole passage is so profound. And it makes sense to me. And these two, and then the whole of the abyss and the answer of heaven, it's absolute Vedic formula.
Right.
So both coexist in this something which is absolutely mysterious and unknown to us. So I'm not proposing minds to take over.
You mean that Buddhism, the emptiness of Buddhism is not leading to anywhere in of you?
No, it is really
the emptiness of Sri Aurobindo leads us to someplace.
Sri Aurobindo explains in exactly by the mind why this sacrifice was made of India towards the absolute. And it's quite interesting. To negate life, to concentrate only on that absolute which is unreachable anyway. And he says why. Because there was no way to, it has to be, the perception of that all has to be sharpened.
So the resolution, by the way, which we can read next time, the resolution of this duality is shown to us. within the same book, within another 10 pages along. And we can read that next time.
My question is somebody here who ever had that experience of emptiness? Did you have this experience of emptiness? Because what I can feel, he is putting in words experience he had, which people can have this kind of experience. It is so known to me what he is saying, because now when he is saying it, I can go back and remember what happens sometimes to me in certain situations. So I don't think that this emptiness can be brought by will, what you said. This emptiness happens to you, and everything he explains happens to you. We cannot do it by will, but he is explaining it in a way so we can understand when it happens to us.
It can happen like that, but it can also happen by will. Because what he's teaching here is that by listening to this command, she enters by her own agreement with it into that emptiness and calls for that descent, and it comes. And so it comes in...
It's an inner call.
Right. So, but there are Buddhists who practice emptiness and achieve emptiness, and then there are those undoubtedly who practice and don't achieve emptiness. But some use mantras and some follow guru yoga, and this practice has been very well developed. And so it's definitely possible to follow a path with this intention, just as it is possible for it to happen as a result of one's entering into that state. Or one can pursue it in this way. And I know that the reading of Savitri itself can precipitate a complete understanding and grasp and sensual experience of that emptiness. But it's momentary. When that happens, it's not a realization of that emptiness, but it is a glimpse of it, an experience of it. And the idea is that by repeating that experience, one makes it more familiar to oneself. Let me just read a couple of lines about how it goes. If you follow that path of intentionality, then you come to this moment, 552, and we'll read this passage next time, but just a couple of lines. An impersonal emptiness walked and spoke in her. Her divine emptiness, well, a dual power at being's occult poles still acted, nameless and invisible. Her divine emptiness was their instrument. The superconscient mystery through that void missioned its word to touch the thoughts of men. So there, the emptiness is a channel and receptacle for the divine force. So they are coexistent.
That is the night, that Vedic night, which is giving a dwelling place for all the beings. It is that, that entity is something in which everything happens, in which world is traveling and acting. It should not prevent it by its, in a way, it is there. The emptiness should be there if all must be.
All the time. Ever present. And at the end of that passage it says, all was as still and even infinity.